following program is provided without charge by Reformed Theological Seminary, which reserves all rights. To learn how you can support RTS, please visit give.rts.edu.
Let's now turn our attention to the Pelagian controversy, which was so significant in St. Augustine's life and ministry. It consumed a lot of his time while he was a bishop there in Hippo. And of course, for those of us that claim to be Protestant, this controversy becomes very significant for us, especially because Augustine, in the midst of this controversy, will articulate his well-known understanding of the doctrines of grace, which were so influential on the Protestant reformers. Before we look at Pelagius's views per se, I'd like to say a little bit historically about who Pelagius was, some of his followers, how the controversy played out, and kind of give a picture of the history, and then we'll unpack a little bit some of Pelagius's views. And you've got a little bit in Bettinson on a couple of the council meetings that dealt with Pelagian views, so you can cross-reference some of that in your reading. Well, as best we know from Pelagius's own pen, he was from Britain. Some have suggested he may have been from Wales, apparently from a coastal area. We know that he had a monastic background, and he shows up in the city of Rome, had a circle of disciples with him there, and then is going to leave Rome before the city is sacked in the year 410. One of his famous disciples was a very gifted lawyer by the name of Cholestius. And Cholestius is going to be very important in our story because he will be the focal point of some of the condemnation that the church will issue toward Pelagian views. But this very bright lawyer becomes a disciple of Pelagius, imbibed his particular teaching, is going to become a vocal advocate of these views, especially in North Africa, in Carthage, where he will first encounter some direct challenges to his views. The other individual that I'll mention, and this is a bit later in the story, is a bishop in Italy named Julian of Eclanum. And Julian will be really the target of Augustine's longest work that he pens in opposition to Pelagian views, which is simply called Against Julian. And he will be one of the bishops that will resist the church's clamping down on Pelagian views. Well, Pelagius and his disciple Cholestius leave Rome, make the way to North Africa around the year 410, 411, and actually pass through the city of Hippo. But wouldn't you know it, Augustine was gone on business pertaining to the Donatist controversy at the time. And ironically, Augustine and Pelagius, whose names are always found together in the story of African Christianity, never met. Pelagius would continue his travels to Palestine, but yet Cholestius stayed there in North Africa and traveled on to Carthage, and at one point applies for ordination as a presbyter, and then as his views are become open, there was an African council there in Carthage in the year 412, which accuses him of false teaching and really excludes him from the fellowship of the church at that time. Cholestius then goes on to Ephesus, where he was welcomed into the church and ordained as a presbyter. And meanwhile, as I mentioned, Pelagius had traveled on to Palestine, and a dispute emerges there over his views through a letter that surfaces. He had written a letter to a nun, which somehow became public knowledge, and a couple of the leaders of the church there in Palestine made Pelagius' views known to Bishop John of Jerusalem. And so not only was that data made public, but also the condemnation of his disciple Cholestius back in Carthage. That knowledge was made known in Palestine also. So underscoring the fact that there had been a pretty wide opposition to Pelagius' views. Well, meanwhile, it was decided to put these questions, theological questions, before Innocent, the Bishop of Rome. And so that is going to take place. Meanwhile, there was another Palestinian synod led by the Bishop of Caesarea. And in this particular incident, though, interestingly, Cholestius's views were moderately condemned by Pelagius, and he basically argued that his disciple had misspoken and had been misunderstood. And at this point, Pelagius escaped condemnation. And we do find in the East that he was faring a little better than he had by the Africans. Well, again, some African synods, not to be denied, condemned Pelagius and Cholestius in the year 416 again. And Innocent, meanwhile, is proceeding with condemning the Pelagian views as the Bishop of Rome, but he dies before this official ruling is made, and then he is succeeded by the new Bishop of Rome, Zosimus, who seemed to be a bit more indifferent to these things and felt like the Africans were kind of overstating the case. And but the Africans, not to be outdone by the Bishop of Rome, did meet again in the year 418. This time there were over 200 African bishops, which collectively stated their opposition to this theological heresies of Pelagius. And at this point, Zosimus is backed into a corner, if you would, and he issues a papal encyclical which affirmed the decisions of Carthage, thus condemning both Cholestius and Pelagius. Meanwhile, about 18 bishops in Italy were unwilling to bow to this decree of the Pope. Among them was Julian of Eclanum, who I mentioned earlier, the one who became the target of Augustine's lengthy work against these views. Well, eventually, the Cholestius and Pelagius take up exile in Constantinople. Some believe Pelagius ended up going to Egypt and dying there. We know Cholestius stayed there in Constantinople. We don't know much more about him. Julian would die about the year 450. But Nestorius protected Cholestius and Pelagius there in Constantinople for a season. And eventually, when the Council of Ephesus, which condemned Nestorianism, also condemn Pelagian views at that time also. Well, that's some of the historical overview of what took place during this controversy. But let's now look at Pelagius's particular views. I think it's important to acknowledge as we move into looking at Pelagius's understanding of humanity, that in many ways his views did find precedent in some of the early church fathers, at least in a limited way. I think it's important to remember that in the earliest centuries, the fathers, in opposition to Gnosticism, which had denied free will, did tend to put an emphasis on the will of man and the important role of Christian ethics, obviously in opposition to paganism. And so you see this focus on human effort. Some see a bit of moralism in some of the early fathers. I'm not sure that's always a fair characterization of where they were, because many of them certainly understood grace clearly, and many of them did talk about the reality of the implications of Adam's sin on all humanity. So while Augustine is going to articulate in a very strong way an understanding of original sin in ways that we as Protestants would be familiar with it, this too was not a complete novelty, as a number of the fathers had talked about the fact that man's moral nature had been affected by the fall of Adam. But really, when we get to the Pelagian controversy with which Augustine is intimately involved, we really are beginning to see some new territory developed in terms of the theological category of the doctrine of man. You know, as we've looked at it in the early centuries, we've looked at the issues of authority, we've looked at the doctrine of God, Christology, and now we really shift to a major focus on anthropology. What did the church really believe about the doctrine of man, and what are the implications of the fall? Now, Pelagius, it is said, had acquired a copy of Augustine's Confessions, and when he read a passage there in the Confessions where Augustine had, in a prayer to the Lord, said, "Lord, give what you command and command what you will," that Pelagius had gone into a rage about this because he felt like this undermined his ethical concern for Christian moral living, because Augustine is just acknowledging human impotence to do the will of God, lest God do that work in the human soul. Pelagius had this monastic background. He had been a teacher of asceticism, and so moral effort was very important to him, and he objected to Augustine's strong views on this. Pelagius's views, though, were very extreme. Even though we may say that there was a bit of moralism among some of the early fathers, Pelagius took it to another level in terms of his real denial of the what we would call the full depravity of humanity and the impact of the fall on the soul of all human beings. Now, there's a chart that's you've got, which describes Pelagius and Augustine's views, and also Augustine's views on the human will. If you want to follow along with me on that chart, hopefully that can be helpful to you to get the major framework of their differences here. And I've used the categories of sin, grace, and predestination just in order to give us a grid through which we might understand the contrasting views of Pelagius and Augustine. Basically, in terms of Pelagius's view of man and sin, he understood Adam as having been created mortal. That is, that he was going to die as a part of his creatureliness from the very beginning. Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden injured only himself, according to Pelagius. In fact, he suggested that some who lived before the time of Christ were sinless, and some of the saints in the Old Testament actually had lived lives of sinless perfection. And basically what Adam and Eve's sin in the garden was about, this was a bad example that they left for humanity, not something that would affect their posterity, but certainly just a bad role model, if you would. For Pelagius, both the law and the gospel could lead to the kingdom. Newborns, human beings, after the time of the fall, enter the world just like Adam and Eve, with really no sin in their life and the complete freedom of will. All humanity did not die in Adam, and we can live without sin if we will to do it. So the fall, in essence, had no effect on human ability. Each person has the moral responsibility to pursue a life of obedience to God. Now, how Pelagius understood grace on a number of different levels, certainly that original grace from creation that we are given free will, these natural endowments that we have, rationality and other things, but part of God's grace is the revelation of His will to us. He shows us the way that we are to follow and live lives of obedience. Now, following from that, in terms of the notion of predestination, in the way Augustine will articulate that, was totally rejected by Pelagius. God simply foreknows human decisions. Those who are going to choose out of their own free will to follow God and live obedient lives, and those who will not. And that was his understanding of predestination. All right, then, so for Pelagius, far as sin, complete moral ability, his understanding of grace, the gift of free will that we have, and how God's will for human beings has been made known to us through His commandments and in the life of Christ, who we are to emulate. And then predestination, simply His foreknowledge. Well, we can place an opposition to that diametrically, the writings of Augustine. And the reason he took so seriously these views of Pelagius, and these were grievous errors that undermined the teaching of the Bible. Augustine would give great energy to this issue. In fact, we have from his pen 15 different books that he would write on Pelagianism. The whole debate over the will of man, his writings on the book of Genesis, and also grace and free will, and then dealing with the notion of sin and grace, three of his well-known books, The Spirit and the Letter, Nature and Grace, and then also On Original Sin. So if you have an interest in pursuing more of this, you can look in those works. We also have filled with so many of Augustine's writings, letters, sermons, inferences to the Pelagian controversy, because he tried to argue against this at every point he could, because he saw it as so dangerous to the life of the church. Well, now, for Augustine, sin had to do with concupiscence, those sensuous desires within man, and for Augustine, sin was a privation of good. And basically it centered around self-love in place of the love of God. Man was created immortal, and he would have remained so if he would not have sinned. But of course that did not take the place, and this certainly impacted not only Adam and Eve, but all of their posterity. Now, in terms of his understanding of sin, the doctrine of original sin was very important for Augustine. He saw this as very biblical as he looked at the book of Romans in particular, and in Genesis. An analogy for original sin for Augustine would be like an hereditary disease that a person gets. And from Augustine's frame of reference, this was something that was transmitted biologically, this organic connection that all human beings have to him, and this is transmitted then to all of Adam and Eve's descendants. An implication of this was the total depravity of man, unable to do any spiritual good in the sight of man. Now, Augustine would say, sure, human beings can do good things, civil good, acts that are praiseworthy, but they're not spiritually good in God's sight, because they're not done out of a pure motive of love to God. One of Augustine's favorite texts was from John 15, that I'm the vine, you are the branches, and apart from me, you can do no good thing. And Augustine recognized that. I think it's important to point out at this juncture how much this was a real personal issue for Augustine, much like some of the later famous testimonies to grace, like Luther and John Wesley. This was a very personal issue for Augustine because he had experienced the depravity of his own sin and knew in his own experience that apart from the grace of God, he was utterly and totally condemned and lost before God and had no ability to turn his heart toward God. So his articulation of the doctrine of grace is so identified with Augustine. And so as we've talked about his sense of sin, at least in later language, we talk about a kind of total depravity, all of man's being impacted by the fall, and that this grace ultimately was something that God would do supernaturally in the heart of man. The will of man must be renewed after the fall, and God's grace actually changes the will. An analogy might be the story of the Good Samaritan. Completely destroyed by sin, laying along the roadside, and someone else must come along and lift us out of our horrific situation. Now, Augustine could certainly talk about, the will of man to a certain extent to being free, but only according to the ability of his will. And it's the Holy Spirit who comes and now changes this inner disposition so that faith is a gift and this grace is given in order that we might believe. And this was the understanding for Augustine of this grace that would come. And then as a result of that, an implication of both the fall and then God's grace now is Augustine's articulation of predestination. Through his own study of Romans 9 in particular, Augustine would modify his own views. He had early on apparently embraced views more in tune with an understanding of God's foreknowledge. But he eventually came to view this as inconsistent, not really faithful to Scripture. So if grace, in effect, is the efficient cause of our salvation, this leads then, logically and biblically, to the doctrine of predestination. As Augustine would say, what God does in time to renew the sinner, he willed to do in eternity. He would speak of it in terms of salvation viewed sub specie aeternitatis, that is, salvation viewed from the point of view of eternity, just an eternal perspective on what God's grace does in time. And then an implication of that, that God's preterition of the non-elect, God's passing over. All of us are part of this mass of perdition. And God simply leaves some in their sin and in his mercy chooses to deliver others. And this was his understanding then of predestination. As it sometimes has been described, it is both an undeniable fact and an inescapable mystery. So then for Augustine, in contrast to Pelagius, under our three categories of sin, grace, and predestination, and I'm using later nomenclature that Augustinians would use, especially in its Calvinistic version later on. We talk about sin in terms of total depravity, grace being irresistible, that is, that God accomplishes his work to change the will of man. And then this predestination, of course, is unconditional, not based on any foreknowledge of God about what a person may or may not do, but certainly his complete and sovereign mercy to do that. Now, in this context, I'd like to take a side trail here for a moment to talk about Augustine's perspective on the human will. And this is integrally related to this whole discussion of Pelagianism. And Augustine gives us a great framework for understanding the different states of the human will. This would be something that the later Puritans would certainly latch on to. They were very drawn to Augustine's teachings on the doctrine of grace. And in fact, if you'll look in the Westminster Confession of Faith. This is a great document produced by the English Puritans of the 17th century. In its chapter on free will, you will find, in essence, St. Augustine's framework for how we are to understand the human will scripturally. Again, if you look on the chart that's been provided, the Latin terms are there that Augustine used in his writings. And then a basic translation of what those Latin terms mean. But I think this grid is very helpful for getting a handle on how we can understand the will of humanity. The way Augustine explained this, and this again is being drawn from a variety of his writings and the ways that he addressed us, he understood the will of man in four different states. The state of innocence. This is where we can talk about the what we might technically call the freedom of contrary choice, the will of man neither inclined to the good nor to evil. And here we can talk about the freedom of the will in a technical sense, not inclined either way, but a true freedom to choose, able to sin, able not to sin. And Adam and Eve had that particular choice. Of course, as Genesis 3 indicates, things changed in the Garden of Eden with this blatant disobedience to God. And after this time, in the Latin, the human will found itself in a state of non posse non peccare, unable to not sin. Now, I realize that's a double negative in English, which is bad grammar, but in Latin that's acceptable. But it makes it very clear, the Latin does. In other words, sin is inevitable. Human beings will sin, period. That becomes our lifestyle, if you would. Not that human beings are always as evil as they could be, but they will consistently sin because we have a sin nature. The will of man is fallen, if you would. Now, the third state, the state of grace, where we are given the gift of the Holy Spirit. Augustine even seems to suggest here that this, in fact, is a superior state to the state of innocence, because now we have the gift of the Spirit who can enable us to obey God. It doesn't mean that we don't fall and sin against God, but we have a new ability by the inward work of the Holy Spirit and our cooperation with that act of the Spirit, that we may live lives of obedience before God. And then finally, the state of glory, which in many ways I think is the great hope that we as believers have, that in the final state of glory that we will be unable to sin. And in many ways, this we could describe as true freedom of the will. This is the freedom of the will that God Himself has, because as we know, because of God's perfect nature, God Himself does not have the freedom of contrary choice. God cannot choose to do evil. God cannot choose to do sin, because that's contrary to His nature, to who He is. And in that state of glory, human beings will be like God in that sense, and we will be truly free at that point. And I don't know about you, but that is certainly the great hope I have, that someday I will be freed from sin completely, and I will only choose to do that which is good. And that will be true liberty, true freedom, and we will be truly godly in that sense. So the four, then, states of the will along these categories is just a helpful way to understand what the Bible conveys to us in terms of what happened in Genesis 3, and then the depravity of man, God's grace that comes, and the gift of the Holy Spirit, and then what we have to look forward to in eternity. And Augustine was very clear in articulating this particular understanding of the will, which would really influence the rest of Christianity. All right, let's conclude this unit on St. Augustine and African Christianity by looking at just a a few parts of the African story that developed after the time, really, of Augustine. And we've certainly talked about a number of these influential theologians in Africa and their contributions to the ongoing life of the church. But Christianity took early root there and would continue to flourish as you move into the Middle Ages, but they are going to suffer some severe situations, no question about it. One of the places where we see the most primitive forms of African Christianity all the way to the earliest times would be in what we know as the Coptic Church of Egypt. The Copts are indigenous Egyptians, that the Coptic language is the Bible, was translated into their language, the liturgy. The Copts would be Monophysites long term when all of the differences played out at the time of Chalcedon. The Copts opted for the one nature viewpoint, which put them a little bit on the outs with the rest of the Eastern Church and some real tensions with the Eastern emperors because of that. But they can certainly trace their connections all the way time to the early life of the apostolic church. In Egypt, we can't talk about Christianity without mentioning this development of monasticism. I don't know if you can see the Nile and its tributaries there. It's kind of light on the map, but it's in this area that monasticism will be born. And in many ways, it's from the fruit of this development that the African church will really nourish not only the Eastern Christianity, but Western Christianity. And in our next unit, when we look at monasticism, we'll see how some of the Western men had spent time in the deserts in Egypt and were able to take a lot of that practice and thinking about the Christian life back toward the Western church. But it's one of the reasons why when we consider Eastern Orthodoxy, how monasticism is just ingrained in every part of their life together. Now, the big challenge that Egypt is going to face, obviously, is the period of Islamic invasion, as the armies of Arabs will move down into Africa. The conquests happen very rapidly into the 7th century. And while the Copts were certainly Christian, because of that, some of that tension with the other Christians in Byzantium, they were not completely distressed about their new Islamic invaders, because one of the things that the Arabs did in the early generations, especially, is they tolerated the Coptic religion, where the Copts felt a little persecuted from the other Eastern churches after Chalcedon. The Arabs tended to be tolerant. And the Muslim leaders depended upon these Copts, particularly those that were highly educated for their literary acumen, administrative duties, their commercial skills. And so there's kind of a blending of Islamic and Coptic culture there in Egypt. But by the 10th century, the Copts become a minority population in Egypt. And as a minority faith, they had to live in separate communities, wear distinctive clothing. They could not marry Arab women. Evangelism became against the law. And so in many ways, the Coptic faith turned inward, and that's a part of why that indigenous form of Christianity is as it has existed through the centuries, because they were kind of cut off from the rest of the church in many ways. But the Coptic language would stay alive in the translation of the Bible and in the liturgy. And internally, were able to maintain a bit of independence, as the Arabs would let them practice the faith, and they tried to stay out of politics. Now, it got really problematic, this relationships that the Copts had with the Arabs during the time of the Crusades. You know, how are the Egyptian Christians going to deal with this whole issue? They're living in the midst of Islamic culture. These Western Christians are coming in and invading the Middle Ages. So some of the Crusaders did make their way down to Egypt, and in some ways it made things worse for the Copts, as they would come under suspicion because they were Christians, and, you know, are they going to be disloyal? So they had to be pretty careful about their contacts with the Latin church. But the Coptic faith would survive, and you can travel to Egypt today and find Coptic Christians, very heavily influenced by monasticism and the ancient faith as they understand it. They are, again, of the Monophysite persuasion. Now, it's through the Coptic church, because obviously Egypt, reaching right up into the territory of Palestine, so as the gospel was spread down into that area, and it's from the Coptic Christians then that the faith would continue to move down the Nile River Valley, going southward into what would be ancient Nubia, modern-day Sudan. Yeah, sure, the Monophysite, that word means one nature. One nature. And they took that Eutychian view that in understanding the person of Christ, that we see a union of the human and the divine. Right, one nature. It would say that the human and the divine nature were merged together in the one person, but certainly never questioned his full deity. But it was considered, you know, outside the official Orthodox faith, and so they were persecuted a bit by the, you know, rest of the church. So they continued to survive, though, thankfully, in the midst of the Arab context. Well, the faith would go down into Nubia. Coptic Christianity was taken south through trade between these peoples, and monastic communities continued to go southward. And this part of Africa really had never, ever been a part of the old Roman Empire. And so a bit of independence there. Of course, ancient Egypt had been a part of the Roman Empire. And the old Greek empire of Alexander the Great. You know, Egypt had was very significant part of his empire. But as you're moving down into Nubia, a distinctive Nubian Christianity will develop there. The Arabs made treaties with some of these Nubian kings because this was their southern border of their territory with the Islamic conquest coming down into Africa. And so the Nubians had to have negotiations with the Arabs. But they were able to develop their own Christian culture and really resist the influence of Islam. And they tended to look to the Byzantine church for some of the court models there in developing their theology and practice. But they did end up going in the same direction as the Copts, which makes sense because of that connection of a Monophysite direction. The Copts supplied the monks, the priests, and many of the bishops for the Nubian church. But some of the archaeology does suggest that some of the Nubian priests were black Africans. Now, the persecution did begin, though, in the 12th century. This was a Christian kingdom of Nubia. But by the 12th century, this pressure by aggressive Muslims that had taken over Egypt and an Arab invasion and settlement into that part of Africa. Many of their church buildings were destroyed. And by 1500, Christianity had almost completely been destroyed from Nubia. And of course, in modern times, the 19th century, one of the most famous Protestant missions, SIM, which has its headquarters here in Charlotte, originally was the Sudan Interior Mission, in a sense trying to re-Christianize that part of Africa as it had really fallen under the Arab conquest. Now, another unique version of the African faith took root in Ethiopia, the old kingdom of Abyssinia. And it has a unique character that I want to tell you about, especially with its Jewish connections.
which is still distinctive of the ancient Ethiopian church, and they're still proud of a lot of those connections. I've had friends that have been missionaries in Ethiopia and spent time with some of these Christians there. They face the same pressure from the Muslims as Nubia did, but Christianity will survive. Ethiopia down off the map, really below Sudan, so we're still transgressing either even further down the eastern shoreline there of Africa and along the Nile. And the Ethiopian Christianity will also survive, thankfully. There were two merchants from Syria that did a lot of the gospel work in ancient Ethiopia and spread the gospel through the royal court there. Two men named Frumentius and Aetius. You see their two names here were instrumental in bringing the gospel down from Syria. And Frumentius goes to Egypt at one point and discusses the needs in Ethiopia with Athanasius. Remember Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria there in Egypt. And Frumentius was consecrated as the Bishop of Ethiopia, what is known in the Ethiopian church as the Abuna, A-B-U-N-A, the Bishop of Ethiopia. Monks from Syria and Egypt spread the good news in the coming centuries. And what you find is in this unique setting that both the crown, the royal family among the Ethiopians, and the church and the Amharic culture were intertwined. That's the name of the language and the culture, Amharic, still the indigenous language of Ethiopia. And so with that ancient culture and with Christianity developing a distinct version of Christianity, which had a unique connection to the Jewish heritage. Ethiopia is really a part of the Semitic world, and Amharic is a Semitic language. And there may very well have been a Jewish culture and communities that were there in this part of Africa before Christianity made inroads there, just like there are Jews in Arabia, just across the Red Sea from this area. And there's a group of people known as the Falasha people of Ethiopia, that for centuries have claimed to have a Jewish heritage. They obey the Torah, they keep the Jewish Sabbath, and the Ethiopian church sees itself as the heir of Judah and of the ancient people of God. And one of their traditions called the Glory of the Kings in the Nabra Negast. I'll just write that up there if you're in the interest. Part of their ecclesiastical tradition about this connection to King Solomon. And the Ethiopians are kind of proud about that, and their discussions about the historicity of this, but at least among some of them, this is a part of their understanding that essentially the Queen of Sheba was from Ethiopia, and she returns from a visit to Solomon. She is pregnant with Solomon's child, who becomes King Menelik the First, the son of Solomon, now the king of Ethiopia. Menelik was to return to Judah and bring back the Ark of the Covenant to Ethiopia. And one of the old traditions is that, you know, one of the ancient mysteries is, where's the Ark? You know, if Indiana Jones didn't really find it, where is it? And one of the traditions was it was carried down to Ethiopia and hidden there. And in the Ethiopian churches, the new ones that are built, they are designed on the plan of Solomon's temple and typically have a replica of the Ark of the Covenant are placed in the center of the churches in the old Ethiopian churches there. Now, since the Protestant missions, there are a lot of other Christian churches and presence in Ethiopia, but I'm talking about those that still see the linkage in the ancient Ethiopian church back to the earlier time. The church would continue to grow there in Ethiopia. They too had to have these very delicate relationship with the Arabs in Cairo, but the most of the real power in the church was held by the abbots in the monasteries, Well, one of the controversies as a part of their heritage is a controversy over the Sabbath. Remember this Jewish connection, and for many years the Christians in Ethiopia kept the seventh day in the traditional Jewish Sabbath, and the Copts felt like that this had been a corruption, and that this Sabbath worship instead of the Sunday worship, and a difference among these African groups. And there was a council in 1450 which settled the dispute, and they basically decided to observe both Sabbaths. Rest on the Sabbath day, and also the Lord's Day worship. Kind of same kind of situation that some of the early Jewish Christians. The tension with Muslims would increase as some of the Arab peoples moved down into that area and becoming an important minority in Ethiopia. And a good bit of mutual tolerance was in place there over the centuries. But by the 16th century, some of the violent Muslim generals invaded and destroyed many of the churches and monasteries of the Ethiopians. It's at this point that we began to see a Roman Catholic connection, because up until this time you can certainly see the lineage of the Ethiopian, indeed all these indigenous African churches, back to the old Eastern Greek-speaking church. But the Ethiopians, having more trouble with the Muslims, called upon Portugal for help. And Catholicism makes its way at the beginning of the 17th century into Ethiopia, and the Catholics made some pretty poor decisions there in terms of practicing rebaptism, reordination, reconsecration of churches, to want to make these ancient Ethiopian churches now Roman Catholic churches. The population resented this very much, having non-Africans to be bishops among the people. And by the later decades of the 17th century, there was a bit of a civil war, and they expelled all the Roman Catholic Jesuits from Ethiopia and dissolved any relationships with Rome at that point. So, you know, while we're having this big to-do in Western Europe with this thing called the Protestant Reformation, you know, the Africans are having their own struggle with the Arabs, and having Jesuit missionaries come down into their area, which eventually they got rid of all of them. Well, the Ethiopian tradition of Christianity independent of Rome, the liturgy certainly points back to Alexandrian influence. So both in Ethiopia and Nubia, you can see where the Coptic faith certainly was a connecting link back to Alexandrian North African Christianity. Still today, much of the Christianity is a part of the peasant life in parts of Ethiopia. They continue to struggle with issues of polygamy and the problems that they have in many parts of the traditional Ethiopian church. Many of the old people are a part of that, but they're Protestant churches, and of course you've got the challenge with some Muslim population also. So Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt, all three today would be areas where, you know, you've got Christian and Islamic populations that can have some very significant tensions, and this began to play out in the earlier centuries leading up to the time of the Middle Ages, and they continue to struggle with it today. But some of these ancient families of churches have got a direct link back to the earliest times, but Protestantism has moved into all those areas and by the grace of God, been very fruitful in a lot of places and had influence there.
The preceding program has been brought to you by Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.